If you're new to the morning show, Bill Bloss has actually been on our show for the last 4+ years. I consider him one of our legal experts. I've gone to Bill to talk about big cases here in Connecticut, about major cases across the country. That's getting a lot of attention and people are talking about here in our state. And it's not necessarily because he has an active role in those cases, but rather I like his insight. He's been doing this kind of work for a very long time. He's with the Koskoff, Koskoff and Beter Law Firm right here in Fairfield County. And what's interesting, though, is, Bill, I can't remember if I've ever had you on to talk about a case that you specifically are representing, but that's the case for today. You're talking about the accusations around ballot box stuffing in the city of Bridgeport ahead of the primary election for the mayoral race, and you're representing the John Gomes party. So thank you for being here, and I look forward to diving into everything. How are you?
Sure, good. I'm fine. Thanks, Melissa.
So, first of all, Bill, talk to us about how you even got involved with this case.
Well, I've been doing election cases around the state for probably 20 years. I represented Ed Gomes, the state senator, on some litigation back in around 2003 to open up the primary process. It seems every cycle in Bridgeport, I am representing somebody, unfortunately,
really?
with some kind of issue, mostly relating to absentee ballot.
That's really interesting. So were you involved at all in what was going on the last mayoral primary in Bridgeport, where it was between Marilyn Moore and incumbent Mayor Ganim?
No, I was not involved in that case in 2019. I've actually represented Senator Moore in other matters. But I did represent State Rep Jack Hennessy a year ago in an absentee ballot problem.
Oh, sure.
In his primary.
That's right. That's right.
So yeah, it is an annual thing. Unfortunately.
All right, so let's even talk about that before we get into this specific lawsuit. Why does this continue to be history repeating itself, it seems? If we continue to have these concrete examples of, it doesn't even matter if one side is more right than the other, like it's not even a political thing. This is a moral thing, right or wrong, that we are potentially frauding people. We're not letting their voices be heard properly. We're not allowing people to have any faith in local government. Why would this continue to repeat itself? It seems like in the city of Bridgeport, but most other municipalities don't have this continuous issue year after year, it seems.
Yeah, this is a Bridgeport problem. This is not a New Haven problem. It's not a Hartford problem. It's not a suburban problem. I think to answer your question, I think there are two things in play. One is that it's just part of the campaign culture, if I can put it that way. The tactics here have historically relied very heavily on absentee ballots, and so there's an operation in Bridgeport that encourages absentee ballots, that collects absentee ballots, and I think we're going to see next week the scale of it in this last primary. But in addition to that, I think that there has been a failure by state political leaders to come to grips with this, to actually call it out and say it should not be happening. You know, I looked at you mentioned the 2019 mayoral campaign with Marilyn Moore and Mayor Ganim. Complaints were filed with the State Elections Enforcement Commission in 2019 about that election. In 2023, almost four years later, the state Elections Enforcement Commission referred three people for criminal prosecution almost four years later. Well, that's not a meaningful sanction if the investigation takes that much time. And in the defense of Elections Enforcement, their investigative budget has been cut. It needs to be beefed up. It needs to be taken more seriously. And state leaders need to say this just cannot continue.
I'm curious really quickly, Bill, before we get into this specific case. You were saying absentee ballot tactics. That's been notoriously done for a very long time in Bridgeport politics. Have you ever heard professionally about fear tactics? I have unofficially, because of course I can't get anyone to confirm it, but I've heard of people, especially those who are living here illegally, but they live in the city of Bridgeport, being, I don't want to say forced, but using fear tactics in who they should vote for and making sure that they do go out and vote. Have you ever heard of cases like that connected to Bridgeport?
Well, are you talking about undocumented aliens? They wouldn't be able to vote anyway. They wouldn't be able to register. But, you know, we are investigating some allegations of people in a rental rebate program who may have been promised to continue
too.
In the program,
yes,
if they voted for a particular candidate.
Yes.
We're looking at that. I'm not sure we're going to have to get into that, frankly, in this case, based on the numbers I'm seeing, but we are investigating.
Okay. So Bill Bloss is here, and again, he's representing John Gomes. This case is pretty compelling, to say the least. I don't know if it takes a rocket scientist to say that. It's been what everyone is talking about across Connecticut and even across the nation. Tell us about the footage, Bill. I mean, how much do both sides have to look at? We know that they're picking the case back up in court next week, and it's allowing both parties to be able to look at all the evidence. How much is being looked at right now?
Well, we've got 2,100 hours of video on the ballot boxes. Each of the four ballot boxes had surveillance cameras that are tied into the Bridgeport Police Department. So we are going to go through every one of those videos. And so we have already identified numerous circumstances of people with multiple ballots. I think it's going to be a pretty compelling presentation when we actually play it in court.
Without giving, obviously, away, because I don't want to, you know, I don't want to impact either side in your case, obviously. But I am curious, when you say that you have a lot of compelling evidence, is there more beyond what the public has already seen that supports what John Gomes is saying?
Well, you know, last week, Melissa, when I was answering that question, I said I wasn't sure if what we've seen publicly is the tip of the iceberg or is the entire iceberg. It's the tip of the iceberg.
Bill Bloss is here. He is representing John Gomes. And this is the case, obviously, that everyone has been talking about in the city of Bridgeport, alleged ballot box stuffing ahead of the primary election for mayor. Question for you, Bill. Are you worried at all about the leaked footage that came out earlier this week showing what looks like several Gomes supporters allegedly stuffing the boxes?
No, I'm really not. I'm not. I have not disclosed any of the video, frankly, that I was given. I can speculate as to where it came from and why, but legally, it makes no difference. The volume is nowhere close to equal.
I'm curious about a couple of things, and of course, I'm kind of having you sort of preemptively give me what you think will happen. So obviously it's not for sure, it's not fact, but I'm just curious, you know, with all the experience you've had, especially with these kinds of cases. First of all, let's talk about both sides really quickly. I have heard John Gomes take this question here on my show and many other platforms. Does he get in trouble at all as to how he got his hands on the footage?
No, you know, I've never really understood what the problem is there. It's not like secret surveillance of an ongoing criminal investigation. It's a video recording of somebody doing something in a completely public place with no expectation of privacy. So I don't really even understand what the claim is there. I think the police should have been more proactive about getting it out into the public before the primary, honestly, because the footage that we've seen was a week before the primary. Well, what was going to happen with that if it wasn't disclosed. That's something I've just never understood.
Now, speaking of the police, that was going to be my next question. So from the, I don't want to say the other side, because I think police are supposed to be, you know, not political, but does Chief Porter get in trouble potentially? Does, we know that obviously this woman who allegedly is seen doing what could be ballot stuffing, she obviously could lose her job or something else. But what could happen to Chief Porter, and does anything happen to Mayor Ganim?
Well, so this, I mean, let me take one at a time. I don't know about the chief. I don't know what the police knew and when they knew it and what did they do with it. I know that they did make a referral to elections enforcement before the primary on one issue. We've been given paper on that. But in terms of what the deliberative process was about that referral and what else should we do with the information, you know, I don't know the answer. So I can't really comment on what you know, the police did or should have done. In terms of Mayor Ganim, as with Mr. Gomes, there's no allegation in the case that this was ordered by either of the candidates, or that even that either candidate encouraged it. But we don't need to show anything like that. We need to show that ballots were deposited in the drop boxes by somebody other than the voter, and in that, if that happened, those votes don't count. It doesn't. The good faith of the candidates are immaterial to that. But I will say, you know, if there is evidence that anybody, regardless of which quote side they're on, close quote, there should be consequences to that action. We just can't tolerate this kind of conduct, whether it's in favor of our candidate or the other candidate.
So this probably sounds like a very elementary question, Bill, because obviously, you know, a huge end goal here is to change the way that we have allowed, I'm going to call it, crooked politics to allegedly go on. And we sort of talked about that before, but what is your client's end goal here? A new primary to be named the Democratic nominee? Like, what is the end goal? What does he want to gain from this case?
Well, I think there are two things. One, or we have asked in the alternative either that if a certain number, an adequate number of absentee ballots are disqualified, that he should be declared the winner of the primary, and that sometime there would be a new general election involving only him on the Democratic line and whoever the other candidates would be on other line. That would happen after the November general election that's already scheduled. That election's going to happen regardless. But there could be a new election or a new primary and a new election after the scheduled general election. But the second thing I think Mr. Gomes is looking for is a reordering of the culture, frankly, the political culture in Bridgeport. Mm. What has happened in Bridgeport in the last, you know, however many elections has really bred some cynicism and lowered participation, and it's bad for the citizen participation, and it just needs to change.
And of course the court case is going to get picked back up next week, and we'll be keeping tabs on it as well. I mean, what are the chances, Bill? Last question. If, you know, you had said a couple minutes ago, if there's enough substantial evidence, or there was enough, let's just say, absentee ballots that are fraudulent, if there's enough that it proves that John Gomes should have been the winner, but what if there's not? What if there isn't enough evidence proving that, okay, even if the actions were stuffing the boxes, but Ganim still won by a landslide. Does this whole case just become irrelevant? Like, what happens if the count is really not that high, even if there is fraud?
Well, he didn't win in a landslide under any circumstances. He won by 251 votes, is the current total. So that's, pretty close. But win or lose, we are going to shine a light on some pretty dark practices, I think. And I think it's going to be ultimately up to state regulators, police, chief state's attorney's office about what consequences will come out of all of this. But I also hope that it will be maybe the first step in changing the political culture in Bridgeport, and voters will say, you know what, we've had enough, and we're not going to let these kinds of tactics work in Bridgeport.
Well, Bill, I know that we will be in touch, and I look forward to seeing how things continue in court next week. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on this morning.
My pleasure.
All right. Bill Bloss again of Koskoff, Koskoff & Beter, and he is the attorney representing John Gomes in the lawsuit in Bridgeport of alleged ballot box stuffing ahead of the primary mayoral election.
Melissa in the Morning spends a few minutes with U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal. Now on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Senator Blumenthal, welcome back to the show. So glad to chat with you. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well. Hope you and your listeners are too.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Senator, I know there's a lot happening in Washington, D.C. I know there's a lot going on even here in Connecticut as well. But I think this really is something that a lot of people are thinking about right now, because we've had two real tragedies here in the last month. As I'm sure you know, last month there was a 16-year-old boy in Bridgeport who was mishandling an unsecured gun in a home with a friend of his, and it went off and killed him. And just last weekend, we had a 14-year-old boy in a home by himself, where police later said 23 guns were in the home, and most of them were unsecured. And he was playing with a revolver and shot himself in the head. He is still fighting for his life in the hospital. And I guess the question here is not a question of people's rights with guns, because, again, I don't really think this comes down to should people own guns or not. I think that's people who want to get into a fight when they hear conversations like this. I want to talk more about the importance of securing guns. In a state that created Ethan's Law, how could this still be such an issue?
Great question, Melissa, and thank you so much for focusing on this issue. Because first, there's no issue here about people having guns. It's about how they store them. Mm-hmm. What happened with Ethan is a tragedy reminiscent of these two instances. Ethan was shot by a neighbor's gun that was improperly secured, and he died as a result. And that is the reason that Kristen Michael Song, his parents, have crusaded for Ethan's Law at the state level, where they were successful, and now at the federal level, where I have championed this cause of safe storage, not taking guns away, but safe storage. And we're making progress. More of my colleagues are in favor of it. But the reason for these tragic shootings relates to people's irresponsibility. The owners of those guns simply failed to store them properly. And Ethan's Law would impose penalties on them. There's been no word, as far as I know, about their being prosecuted in some way, but the penalties can always be increased to provide stronger deterrence. There's no question that Ethan's Law has helped to save lives, because it's made people more aware about the need for self-storage. And the penalties are hardly severe if people are found to store their guns improperly. That is, that they are required to secure them under either lock and key or in a safety box. Basically, store them in a way that kids can't have access, nor can others who may be at risk have access.
And, you know, and I think obviously that, like you said, it's progress, right? I mean, it's going in the right direction, even having some kind of legislation in place. And certainly penalties, that's one part of the puzzle. But like anything in life, You know, when you see alcohol, you know, keep out of reach of children. If there's something that is considered flammable, keep out of reach of children. You know, we have the warnings out there, or you could have some real problems. There could be injury. You know, parents could be charged with negligence. It goes on and on. I guess the other part of the puzzle, though, that I'm curious about, and forgive me, Senator, I don't know. I know Ethan's law pretty well, but I think a lot of times as journalists, we focus on the bigger thing, which is the penalties. You know, that's like the sexy headline there. But I'm curious if this is included in the legislation. Is there any sort of requirement that when people get their gun permits, that there is some kind of either course or something included in their process of you know, either buying guns or getting their gun license to understand the severity of an unsecured gun? And I ask that question because, for example, like in driver's ed, we have the impacts of if you drink and drive. We've just added to Connecticut, we're going to understand what the impacts of cannabis use and driving are. So I'm wondering if we do the same thing. Like, is there an educational part to this law? Because part of, I think, what I'm learning on this show is that we can put a bunch of things in place, but we also could try to be more proactive. Is there a way to help families understand better the severity of just because you've got a teenager and you leave your keys out and you know they're not going to take the keys to the car? It may not be the same with your gun, and really understanding the importance of having those conversations with your teens and really understanding the severity of the problem at hand. Is that something that's addressed, or is that something in place?
It's not in place in federal law right now, nor is it part of our federal legislation that people would be required to go through education courses. It's a great idea. And, you know, the NRA, National Rifle Association, used to be very strongly in favor of safe storage steps. And they still say they're in favor of safe storage, but they have opposed our proposed law. Education is enormously important for gun owners. And, you know, most responsible gun owners, in fact, keep their firearms under lock and key, so to speak, maybe not exactly lock and a key, but they keep them safely stored somewhere because they're aware of the damage that could be done if someone who wants to kill himself, for example, has access to them. This law applies to help protect not only children, but also people who may have mental health issues. One of the very sad and generally unknown facts about firearms deaths is that more than half of them are done by people taking their own lives. More than half are suicides. So safe storage has a lot of ramifications, and you're right, education is tremendously important. But as important as education, I think, is the legal force of a requirement. Right now, the penalties are fairly minimal in the federal law because we want to get it passed and see whether it can't work through education and awareness. And I think it could well have tremendously beneficial effects, as Ethan's law has done. These two tragedies are really shocking, but I am hopeful that more broadly, and I really believe it has helped to prevent a lot of deaths in Connecticut. Ethan's law has been a success.
Well, Senator Blumenthal, do you think there would be a chance to add to this law? Like I said, I know that that's only a snippet, but I do find that I feel like in some regards are adding more education to younger people constantly. We're adding to their curriculums, what is being added to their schools, what is being added to their academics, to their driving schools, to their colleges, to all of that. But I find that as soon as you become a parent or a responsible adult who can buy guns, and again, I have no problem with that, I find that it's like you have to go out and find the education. You have to go out and find, like, even something as simple as when you get your permit. Is there anything that is handed out with somebody outlining Ethan's Law? Like, is that something that Connecticut does? Do we give people with their, you know, congratulations, here you go, here's your certificate. Oh, by the way, here's a handout. I mean, do we do anything in that regard to better educate adults?
I am really unaware, Melissa, I have to say, about what the practices are. But I do know that a lot of responsible gun sellers will provide some advice or education. In fact, some actually provide the gun locks. They are portable gun locks. They're not safes or storage boxes, but those kinds of devices are often provided. In fact, some of the advocates provide them as well. But let me just answer very directly. I think your idea is very important, and I'm going to look into what we can do at the federal level to provide more education and awareness through our Ethan's Law proposal.
I'm also wondering, too, Senator, as I'm thinking out loud, and again, I'm not looking to solve the problem in one sit-down conversation, but I'm wondering if there's also an incentive for people to buy whatever they need to secure their guns. What I mean by that is, like, for example, when the pandemic was going on, we made all the testing free. You know, we're trying to get people to test again because the numbers are going back up again. So I know that soon we're going to be offering from the federal government more free tests for COVID to, again, get people to make sure they're testing, being responsible, caring for other people. Like, I'm wondering if there's some kind of an incentive, not that there's just money flowing, but I'm wondering if there's some kind of an incentive for even gun manufacturers to somehow make those safe storage, either units or anything, more affordable so that people are more inclined. Like, I think about when you buy furniture, for example, and they're like, hey, do you want to buy the insurance? You're like, nope, I don't want to buy the extra $200. But 9 times out of 10, you're like, man, the dog ruined it. The kid spilled on it. Really wish I got that insurance. And I'm wondering if that has anything to do with the equation as well. Like, do people just not even want to bother with it because they think it's not going to be me? I'm not going to have a problem with this.
One of the proposals in connection with Ethan Law at the federal level is to offer a tax deduction for the purchase of gun storage devices. For example,
oh, that's awesome.
If you purchase a lockbox for a couple of $100, you can get a tax deduction. That's the proposal. But in my view, that's no substitute alone for some kind of mandate or other incentives that will be more effective, because the deduction, remember, is only from the taxes that you may pay, and that payment of taxes is a long way down the road, so I'm not sure it's enough of an incentive. So I think we need to look at both incentives and mandates, no question about it, and more education. That's a really important idea, and if you don't mind, what I'm going to do is look into existing laws and our proposals at the federal level and see what we can do about providing more effective education.
That would be great. I really appreciate you looking into it and staying on top of the Senator Blumenthal. And thank you so much for your time this morning to talk about it. I really appreciate it.
Great to talk. Thank you, Melissa.
All right. Senator Richard Blumenthal here on WACC.
Let's get wild. It's the Zoo Minute with Greg Dancho from Connecticut's Beardsley Zoo on Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
It was in our news earlier this week that Chiang Bai was going to be leaving the zoo and going to a new home, and it was going to be a sad departure, but also some happy news on the way for the zoo and their new tiger habitat. Greg Dancho is here with all the details. Hey, Greg, how are you?
Good morning, Melissa. How are you today?
I'm doing fine. Thank you so much. So are you feeling some bittersweet feelings? I know that this is obviously all for conservation, and I know that you have a job at hand, but secretly, were you sad to see Chiang Bai go?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Because the situation was that we had an exhibit that has been over 35 years old, and we needed to make it bigger and better. So So when I first started working here, I saw the Tiger exhibit built, and now I'm seeing it end its useful life here.
Wow.
And now we're going to be going on to a new building.
And is it going to be in the same area, Greg? Because I know a couple people heard the story in my news earlier this week, and they were wondering, are we just expanding what is currently there? Is it going on a different part of the property?
No, yeah, so basically what we're doing is we're taking the old habitat and, mm-hmm. and demolishing it. And if you've been here recently, you've seen the new Andy and Bear habitat. We're going to be building something very similar to that.
Okay.
It's going to be a very much larger holding area with a maternity wing in it, a kitchen inside of it. So inside, it'll be much larger for the tigers. And we'll be having an outside area for them to be able to go outside during the night. And so that we're really excited. And then the whole area is going to be expanded all the way down to the leopard habitat. And so the much, much larger areas to roam around in.
So will the also Amur leopards have to move? Will they have to move?
No, the leopards will be there.
Okay.
We're actually going to have three yards, and the third yard that's going to be closest to the leopards will be a yard that either tigers can use or the leopards can use.
Oh, cool. That's awesome.
So we can use it as a flex space.
Okay, so Greg, really quickly, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I probably have this wrong. I thought you had two tigers on property.
No, we had just Chang.
Okay, just Chang.
We had the two cubs from Chang.
Right.
Chang was moved to the Columbus Zoo. Then the two tigers that we had, the two cubs, were moved through the SSP program to other facilities. And then Chang came back.
Okay.
And now Chang has left again.
Okay. Now I vaguely remember that. Yeah. So I knew Chang left and came back. But for some reason, I totally forgot about the babies moving. But that's right.
Yeah.
And now
so Chang,
okay. Yeah.
Chang won't be coming back. Chang will be going to her new home. And we really can't say where that is yet because, and people have asked that question.
Because right now we're waiting for the other facility
to announce it.
Okay. Oh, they have to announce that she's now there. Okay, got it.
Yeah, yeah.
But
it's just protocol.
Though. And yes, like she's made it. She's okay.
Yo, she's definitely there. Definitely okay. Doing well. They're all excited at the facility, and it is through an AZA facility. So it's another AZA program.
I'm just going to ask a question, and you could say no comment, but then I'll know secretly that you mean yes. Is it by any chance a place that I recently went to? And I think you know where I went.
Yeah, probably not.
Okay. I was just checking.
Yeah, you definitely
have to take a plane to get to her. Okay. I was just curious.
You definitely have to take a plane to get to her.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's good.
But she traveled. She traveled. Again, people have asked, how did she move her? Which she was put in. She was able to walk into a crate. We trained her to go into a crate. So she went in there. And then she was put in a vehicle that transported her to the new facility. They take temperatures. They stop frequently. They have a camera that's able to monitor the cat in the enclosure. And so it's done tremendously well. And actually, the people are veterinarians.
Oh wow!
That do this. So
that's
it's
awesome.
It's a great way to move the animal very safely and very humanely.
I love that. So Greg D'Angio is here from the Beardsley Zoo. And speaking of some movement with animals, let's talk about the new Andean bear, Nuna. Sounds like she's out
Nuna.
In the night yard and slowly getting acclimated to the habitat there, within the next week or so? That's exciting.
Yeah, Nuna, again, her name means soul or spirit from the people in the Andes. And she came out this week for the first time. She did pass her quarantine. And was able to come outside and to the night yard. And so she's getting used to the sights and surroundings. And she's able to see now Kayumbe. So they get to get nose to nose and start to get used to each other. And that will happen for about another 2 or 3 weeks. And then we'll have her put out with Kayumbe. Now, again, we'll not probably put them together completely for another couple, 3 weeks. We just want to make sure that they really are compatible together, and then we'll put them together.
What if they're not compatible? What happens?
Well, then they'll stay separate.
Oh, they can still coexist. They just won't go near each other.
Yeah, Andean bears, as a whole, are not family animals.
Oh,
they really
but
rather
so cute.
Be separate.
But I
mean,
them.
But Nuna is 2 years old, and so she's still kind of being. She wants to have a little more companionship, I think. You know, so Kayumbe could be a mother figure for a little while.
Okay, all right, that's cool. Well, I think that's really exciting. So when you say that they need to do kind of their introductions, will we be able to see both of them in their habitats right now, or do we still need to wait the couple of weeks?
If you come to the zoo now, Kayumbe is in the third yard, which is the yard that if we had cubs, and she's able to get up nice and close to Nuna in the night yard.
Okay.
So, all right. Yes,
can you see how
right
I'm
now.
Like visualizing in my head? I feel like I could,
yep.
Yeah. Okay. That's awesome.
Yeah, you can see it. You may
beautiful.
See Nuna's in the background a little bit, but you'd be able to see her.
Oh, that's so exciting. So you should definitely make a trip over to the Beardsley Zoo. A lot of moving parts over there. As far as the tiger habitat, really quickly, Greg, before I let you go, when is that expected to get underway? And is it going to mean that guests can't really go in that section, like to see the leopards?
Well, we're going to be looking at demolition first. And our plans are for phase one. Phase one is the building of the interior den area.
Okay.
So that's going to be number one. So that should start sometime, hopefully, this spring.
Wow.
And can be completed by next year. And then hopefully at the same time, phase two will start with the outside yards. So I'm looking at 2-3 years
okay.
for this to be completed.
All right. I mean, look, that's a big undertaking. So I'll take that. It's exciting.
Yeah. Right now, that'll be the largest project that this was undertaken in many, many, many years.
Wow. It's a really exciting time for the Beardsley Zoo. And Greg D'Angelo, we love getting the scoop from you each and every week. Thank you so much. And I'll talk to you next week.
Thank you, Melissa.
All
Have
right.
a great weekend.
You too. Greg D'Angelo of the Beardsley Zoo for our Zoo Minute here on Melissa in the Morning.